whoever it is not going away. So he finally gets out of bed and he answers the door, and it's Payne Stewart. And Payne's got the big smile on his face and says, "What are you doing?" And he says, "Dude, I'm already in bed. Yeah, you guys go ahead without me." He says, "No, get dressed and get downstairs." And Tiger says, "Payne, what's the big deal?" He says, "Tiger, the big deal is you never know if you're ever going to get to do this again. So you make it last as long as you can." And, you know, got to remember, this is only Tiger's second Ryder Cup. They've won one, lost one. He looks at Payne and he goes, "Payne, we're going to win this thing over 2 years." And Payne looks at him and says, "You don't know that. Get dressed and get downstairs." And Tiger says, "I'm so thankful that he came back and got me that night." He says, "I'll always remember that night. I'll remember the teammates that I had in that Ryder Cup and how special it was." And Payne was right. That's the only winning Ryder Cup team I ever played on. And we lost him 3 weeks later.
Hey, everyone. Welcome back to the Golfers Journal podcast presented by Titleist, the number one ball in golf. Exciting days indeed. Ryder Cup on the horizon, of course. We're going to get to that with a very good friend of the Golfers Journal. But I can hear that other excitement out there, that buzz in the golf sphere. And it's the sound of mailboxes opening everywhere and then the exclamations of the joy and the happiness that follows thereafter. Yes, Golfers Journal 17. It's out there. You might have it already, or you might even have the, it's almost a good thing when you don't have it yet, still that chance that today's the day you're going to get to go home and find it waiting for you. 17, it's packed with the sort of images and the storytelling that, honestly, for someone like me, just makes you, you know, pretty darn grateful to work for a publication like this. You know, I was just flipping through the table of contents. I mean, we've got Travis, our fearless leader, Travis Hill, diving in on Gene Sarazen. Katie Hafner gives us the story of Marion Hollins that I just, it's the story that I was looking for before I went to Monterey. I wish it was out there then, but it's such a great read. Greg Ohlendorf takes us up to Scotland's most yonder nine-holer. Having been to Durness, I wasn't sure someone could really capture how special that experience is, but he absolutely exceeded expectations. My friend Brett Sergalis also fills us in on what all this Lido reincarnation talk is about here, there, and everywhere. And hey, even write a little essay myself about the greatest golf bathroom you've ever dreamt of using. So you're definitely going to want to check that out. But while you're feverishly working your way through the magazine, well, try to savor it, of course. Don't forget to look out for one of those three golden tickets we've been talking about. If you find one falling into your lap, don't toss it. Like some subscription card. You shouldn't toss those anyway. Give those to your friends. It could change their lives. But it could be the golden ticket. The FootJoy golden ticket giveaway that's basically going to get you one of everything that FootJoy makes, including rain gear, gloves, shoes, bags. It's just this uber prize pack. I can't wait for someone to get it. So if you get the ticket, you know, post it, tag me at CoinWriter. I want to share in the joy and excitement of it. I subscribe myself, so I wonder, what if I get the ticket? That would be bad form. We'll put it back out there if that happens. But speaking of good fortune, I did have some good fortune last week. I had the chance to get fit for the new Titleist irons last week. Thanks, Michael Parker. Philly, shout out to Philly's finest Titleist fitter. It's not easy to say. It was, frankly, got a little emotional watching the numbers sort of move upward. As Michael handed me a different club with a different shaft, we spent about an hour. He really knew his stuff, and I picked up all this wonderful speed. For me, the right iron was the T100S. It's the T100, but just it's got a little extra speed slot in there that actually is making what, to me, you know, it's Titleist, the T100 line, the Titleist Players Club. It's giving the what they've done with the S version is give it sort of the speed and launch that you get from a game improvement club. So, man, that's a pretty strong combination right there. Definitely worked for me. And then the shaft added another 5 yards. So schedule a fitting yourself. I picked up 10 yards. I'm psyched. I doubted how much technology can really go into an iron to make that much of a difference, but the numbers don't lie. And I am going to be hanging out by the front door until those brown boxes arrive. I can't wait to recreate some of the shots we had up on the range You can do it too. Go to Titleist.com and schedule your own fitting today. Get those new irons in your bag. Today's conversation also happens to be with a longtime member of Team Titleist and a longtime friend of my own. We go back to his days at Marion, his first assistant. Before that, he was at Seminole, and that was all before he landed his dream job as head pro at Hazeltine. I'm talking about my good buddy Chandler Withington, who is a great guy. He's also a great artist. Maybe on social media, you might have seen the U.S. Open poster that I had a few years ago. I was traveling around the country with all the logos from all the U.S. Open courses. A lot of people wanted a copy. They're unfortunately long gone. But Chandler made that, hand drew that. He's done the same now with Ryder Cup and Walker Cup venues as well. So very talented and a good guy to know. But for our purposes today, he's also a Ryder Cup super fan and a super expert from within the ropes, which to me is a very rare and cool combination that he brings. I don't know anyone that loves Team USA any more than Chandler does, but he's also got the bona fides of being in the team room. Because he was head pro at Hazeltine, he got to be part of the team that brought home the cup in 2016. And today he's going to take us into that experience, into the team room, into the meetings, and take us into his basement as well, where he binge-watched 20 years of Ryder Cup during a long Minnesota winter, taking copious notes and plotting strategies, and then mustering the courage to share those insights with his lifetime golf hero, Captain Davis Love III. He'll take us into those discussions that Chandler would be too modest to say, but honestly, I think they did make a difference in the outcome. Judge for yourself as you hear the stories of his Ryder Cup experience. So he gives us this perspective, both golf pro, golf fan, but then he also gives us the perspective, a very thoughtful, even emotional perspective. It's perhaps poetic timing right before the 2021 Ryder Cup. The Chandler is saying farewell to his position as head professional at Hazeltine. Those of you who were at our two-man at Hazeltine recently, which got rave reviews from both its participants and the Hazeltine staff, which I think is really cool. Not only, I know we, you know, Broken Tea Society had a great time, but Chandler just said what a great group it was to host. The best he'd probably ever hosted. How appreciative all the TGJ folks were to their staff and how well they treated the staff. So shout out to everyone. I mean, just we're amongst good folks here. And but if you were there, you'd probably be shocked to hear this news from your host from that great day. So soon after the event, the Chandler had decided after a lot of deliberation with his family that he was going to retire as head pro. As tough as I know that that is for him, I couldn't be more excited for him and the new chapters that await him wherever the road's going to take him. And I have a feeling that one of those roads is going to be, I don't know how frequent, but TGJ contributor. I certainly have a hunch about that. So let's turn it over to our Ryder Cup guru, but not quickly before thanking the sponsors from the pages of the Golfers Journal, and they are Titleist, Linksoul, FootJoy, Oakley, Links and Kings, and Scotty Cameron. So if you ever wondered how that Patrick Reed and Rory McIlroy match got put together, or why Michael Jordan doesn't hang around inside the team room anymore, or if you're curious about this year's team chemistry, listen up for some insights from a guy who was in the lab as Ryder Cup chemistry was performed. I mean, there's different ways we could approach the Ryder Cup. I mean, there's a lot of stuff out there. All right, let's break down the lineups, and I definitely want to talk about that. But I want to talk about your experience as, I think what's cool about what happened in 2016 at Hazeltine is that you got to experience the Ryder Cup from the perspective of both being, you know, an insider as the head pro at Hazeltine and had access to what's going on in the team room, et cetera. So you got that perspective, but you also got to experience it, I think, as a fan. Because, you know, you weren't so involved that it was all on your shoulders. You know, you were part of the team, but you're also able to appreciate it from the perspective of someone who's admired Davis Love III for so long. You know, I think that's really cool. When did you first hear that, did you know that, I don't remember the timing, the Hazeltine job, it was open with the Ryder Cup or the Ryder Cup came later?
It was simultaneous. Mike Schultz was the professional here for 37 years and was leaving Hazeltine in the fall of 2012. My first interview here was actually the week of Ryder Cup in 2012 when Davis was captaining the team at Medina. They had called me a couple of days after getting home. So I knew during Ryder Cup week that I was going to get to the final stage of the interview process here. And then I watched Davis and his team lose that hard result there on Sunday of Ryder Cup in 2012, lose a 4-point lead. It was hard to watch at home, not knowing I was going to end up here, but just as a Ryder Cup fan and as a Davis Love fan. And then I got the job here 3 weeks later. And you're an assistant pro for so many years. You're just hoping to become a professional to end up here of all places. And then the next Ryder Cup on U.S. soil is going to be here 4 years from now. It was a thrill. But there was a part of me that was disappointed. I knew the history of Ryder Cup. I'm a historian. No losing captain's ever gotten to do it twice in the 90 years of the event. So I was bummed that he had just captained. I was especially disappointed that the result went the way it did. And I just jumped on board here and was looking forward to finding out who was going to be our captain, and to be a part of a Ryder Cup was really the way it was in 2012.
What's the thing? What's your admiration for Davis? We just had him on the pod. Your name came up in that sort of little inside baseball today, coming back to Chandler. And I was just struck by what a personable, genuine, likable guy that he was. Not that I didn't seem, you know, think that Davis Love III was a likable character on the golf course. He just seemed sort of impenetrable. And we had such a great conversation. It was a blast. Your admiration for Davis Love, where's that come from?
Yeah, it's simultaneous with my journey in golf. I didn't grow up playing golf. I didn't grow up in a golf family. I didn't have any friends that played. 1992 spring break, our family goes down to Hilton Head Island, and we're staying on a house on Harbortown with my cousins, aunts and uncles, who were more the golf side of the family. And the PGA Tour is going on in the backyard, but my cousins were going to go out and watch, uncles and my dad, and I wasn't too excited about it. I was more of a hockey fan as a kid. But once you get out and watch live golf in person, it sucks you in. And this was right in the age of metal woods were starting to come into the game. Persimmon was still around. Metal spikes, walking on cart paths, you know, all those sounds that were kind of romantic to me in that era. But we stood behind a par 5 tee and watched the guys hit driver, and that got my attention. And then Davis, who dominated that tournament for years, came around and hit a persimmon driver out of sight. And he made it look so easy and effortless. And his golf swing, I loved it from the start.
Yeah.
We followed him around that week. He ended up winning and immediately became my favorite player. So when I came home and wanted to learn how to play, my education was to BCR him whenever he was playing in a tournament or a major. And I would just keep rewinding what he was doing and trying to go up in the backyard and imitate it. And kind of what you just said about, you know, Davis's body language is pretty focused on the golf course, and that feeling of, like, you know, he's kind of impenetrable and you don't really know him as a person and you don't know what to expect. I was working at Seminole for the winter about 12 years later, and they have that great pro member the day after the Honda tournament. And Bob Ford, the professional, knew that I'd never met him. And he made sure that I got to caddy for him that year. And there was a mix of excitement and fear. You know, I know a lot of people have met their heroes and they're not great to them. And I was fearful that if he wasn't great to me, I'm going to have to find a new favorite player. And I didn't want to do that. But I could tell you, he could not have been nicer to me, more encouraging of the path that I was on. As you know, his dad was a PGA professional. And that was a magical day for me. And I got to caddy for him again the next year and got to know him a little bit. So that was the start of it. And I was so thankful that he was the person that I hoped he was going to be.
What an awesome journey that you've been on. So you're an assistant at Seminole, you caddy for Davis, and then not that long down the road, you're in the team room with him at the Ryder Cup and he's the captain. I mean, that's about as good as it gets, man. So tell us about, there's been a little bit on Twitter, the talk going into the Ryder Cup. You're always going to have someone with, there's going to be some hot takes out there that the Ryder Cup is as an experience or as a tournament as a golf event is somehow overrated, that it's manufactured for television, that it's pumped up by publicity and PR, and that as it's not really a great golf event. What would you I know how much you bleed, you know, red, white, and blue and the Ryder Cup. What would you say to those takes?
Well, I think we've heard some of the players that have played in the event say those same things. I mean, David Duval going into the Ryder Cup in 99 was kind of a, I don't see the big deal. This is just another week. Rory McIlroy said the same thing back in 2010 going into it. And you saw how both of those players responded. I mean, the emotion comes out of you. Sorry, like there are very few weeks where you get to be a part of a team. You know, golf tends to be a very lonely sport. Sometimes you get to be on a two-man team, but to be on a 12-man team and play for your country, your nation, you know, when you look at Europe, once you get inside of it, it transforms you. And I hadn't been to a Ryder Cup before. The first one I went to was in 2014 at Glen Eagles. And the electricity, you know, when you're walking on the property, you start hearing the murmur and the cheers start going. And the roars for that are louder than anything that I think you'll hear on tour, unless you get a really magical moment like Tiger chipping in on 16 at Augusta in 2005, yeah, or you know, Payne Stewart making the putt, you know, something that we all want to see. The Ryder Cup is different because you're rooting for a side, you're rooting for an entire team, versus every other week on tour, you're rooting for an individual and we're all kind of split on who we want to win. So that's what makes those roars so much louder and unique. And you could be on one side of the golf course and hear a roar and know exactly what happened and who did what. It's unique. It's so set apart. But again, we've seen players who haven't really understood it. And then once they play in one, they understand it.
I'm excited. Yeah. To go. It's my first one this year. I'm going to go to Friday. And are you going?
I'll be there.
All right. We will connect on that. And so it'll be my first time. So I'm excited to see, does it kind of live up to the hype? Are the players going to be, I don't know. It does seem like the highest energy sort of golf experience one could have, but again, I've been watching from the couch. So, I'm pretty excited to get out there and see for myself. Now getting back to yourself and Davis, you go from, again, you know, looking up to Davis, and then suddenly you're sort of a part of this experience. When did you hear that Davis was going to be the captain, and how did that sort of change how you were going to prepare for the Ryder Cup at Hazeltine?
Yeah, well, like I said, I kind of ruled him out in my mind. You know, once he lost in Chicago, you know, they kind of move on to the next ones, right? And then USA, they kind of laid an egg in Scotland in 2014. And if you recall, they came home from that one and PGA announces that they're going to have a task force and we need to figure out how to put this train back on the rails. And I was waiting to find out who the captain was going to be. You know, could they get Azinger out of retirement? The players wanted Freddie Couples to have a chance. A few other names floating around there, but Davis was not one of them. And I was sitting here in my office where I'm talking to you today. It was late February of 2015. And I got a text from a writer in the golf industry who knew me from my time in West Palm Beach when I was at Seminole. It'd been, you know, about 10 years. And the text said, "I remember you from your time down here, and I remember your story. You deserve to know they're going to name Davis Love as captain on Monday." And Tom, I mean, I stared at that text for 15 minutes.
Yeah.
And I think it was that same kind of fear and excitement that I had when I was going to meet him for the first time of, all right, I mean, this is going to be a pretty memorable 2 years, but it's only going to really be great if we win. If we don't win, I'm going to kind of be like an ex-girlfriend. You know, he's not going to want to see me again, but the way that it went, we got to win. And, you know, I find myself going to New York City for his Hall of Fame induction the next year. So it started with that. And I think my mindset walking to my car that night, I was walking through the snow. I was late. And my mindset became, whatever I can do to help this team win, I'm going to do. Because if there's anything I cared about in life to this point, you know, as much as my family, it's winning this Ryder Cup and helping this team win, getting one for Davis. So that was where my mindset went.
Getting one for Davis, the, you know, I'm looking at, that's a good point. We should note here, it's a big deal to get the Ryder Cup. It's really not that big a deal if your side loses in the end. Cause it was funny traveling around when I was doing a course called America, and there's a poster I'm looking at behind you now, that you've done of all the Ryder Cup venues. And if you look at those venues, you know, say like when I went to Medina, there's a lot of stuff about all the events they've had there. And there's not a whole lot about the Ryder Cup, you know, that didn't go so well for the American side, versus then I went to Hazeltine and it was like the Ryder Cup was, you know, it just happened last week, you know, that you're still sort of basking in the victory. So it's a big deal. Winning matters. It definitely matters to the venue.
So you decide, what am I going to do to help this team win? You do a lot more than sort of showing Davis where, you know, the lunchroom is. There's, I mean, you dove in. Tell us about, you know, what did you do to try and help play your part in making that happen?
Well, I think what became obvious to me right away, I mean, I'm never going to swing a club, thankfully, to try and help this team win. But when it comes to the golf course, I can be the expert. But I can also just go back. I spent a lot of time. My parents had just given me the last 20 years of Ryder Cup on DVD for the Christmas beforehand in 2014. So I spent a lot of time in my basement for the next 2 months watching all the old Ryder Cups, but specifically watching the losses. Why do we lose? Is it just they played better? Is there anything that I can pick out? Are there any trends? Is it anything that Europe does or we don't do, or we can learn from past failures? And some stuff started sticking out, and I started putting numbers to that stuff. I was looking for some trends. I found a few, and I put some numbers to it. And when Davis showed up in the summer of 2015, he asked me to play a few times, and I kind of made up my mind. I talked to some people. I said, you know, do I speak up on this, or is it, you know, am I kind of in the background? They said, no, if you got something to add, you need to speak up, or you'll regret it. And it didn't take too long. When we got to the third hole, which is a par five here at Hazeltine, they can play 650. We hit it from the back tees, and, you know, he kind of made a comment of like, yeah, I can tell you right now, we're not going to use that tee for the Ryder Cup. We're 15 months out from the Ryder Cup. And I kind of hit back with like, why do you say that? And he said, well, we need to make more birdies. We didn't make enough birdies on Sunday at Medina. And so we need to move these tees up, get home on the par fives, make a lot more birdies, keep the home crowd involved. And yeah, you know, I understand that.
Yeah.
And I said, but we're 15 months out. You don't even know who's going to be on your team. I said, do you think playing short par fives is an advantage for your team? And he said, yeah, we got guys that can bomb it. And I said, you know, so do they. But if you look back at Glenn Eagles in 2014, specifically alternate shot, I think the mindset was like, well, we stink at alternate shot. We lost 7 points to one on the 8 points in Ryder Cup for alternate shot. It's, if you actually go inside those numbers on the par threes and fours, we were about even or if not a little better. But we got annihilated on the par fives at Glen Eagles on Saturday afternoon foursomes alone. We were four over on the par fives. Europe was eight under. And it was such a drastic difference. McGinley knew that he had par fives on 2, 16 and 18. He put the blocks down at 505. He had really good drivers with really good mid to long iron players. Like on his teams off memory, he had McIlroy driving for Sergio, Stenson for Rose. Dubuisson was the Frenchman driving for Graham McDowell. And then he had Donaldson for, I think it was Westwood or Keimer. So, you know, he had these guys that could drive it great, whereas we had a little different team. And I think McGinley knew that as well. You know, on those holes, we have Zach Johnson driving for Cooch. We had Furyk for Hunter Mahan. It was kind of a five-guard basketball team. We're kind of mismatched. Mm-hmm. I think that's the opportunity in a home Ryder Cup is to look for those mismatches, put it to the strength of your team. What do we do well, and how can we get that happening for us as often as possible? If you look back at the Ryder Cup team here in 2016, we had eight of the best 12 wedge players in the world, you know, from 75 to 125, we were going to beat them. And they had some great mid to long iron players. If it was a game that we wanted to play from 175 to 225, guys like Rory, Sergio, Keimer, Westwood, Stenson, Rose, you go on down the lineup, they were great mid to long iron players. So we wanted to make this a wedge contest, not a mid to long iron contest.
So ball striking versus bomb and gouge. And I don't imagine that that's changed. I wonder if, you know, thinking about whistling straight, I don't know. I think I lost a lot of golf balls. That's what I think about it. And it's really, really hard. I mean, what do you do there to set it up? Is it a golf course where you'd say, all right, well, let's let the wedge play. Let's shorten it, because you can make it, you know, play forever if you want to.
It's a great question on how Strick is going to set that place up. I don't know if it has as much maneuverability. And one thing we were able to do here was we mowed the rough down to about an inch, because we don't drive it as straight as they do. So when you look at Paris or Glen Eagles, they grow the rough up to 6 inches because they drive it straighter. So that's your point about bomb and gouge on the PGA Tour. That tends to be the mindset of a lot of our players. Just send it as far as you can and get as close to the green as you can. And they use that to their advantage when they play at home. They grow the rough up and they drive it a lot straighter than we do. I would imagine with whistling straights, I haven't been following as close. I know the Scouts Inc. guys, the stats guys that we used here in 2016 are still working for the team. So they'll be trying to identify the advantage on the numbers and passing that along to Stricker so he can set it up. With those greens, I imagine a lot of it will come down to hole locations and where you put them, because there's so many different sections on those greens, being a Pete Dye. But we'll see how it all plays out. But that's really what you're looking for when you play at home. It's like, how can we find these little places to cash in?
It's interesting because you do think about Whistling Straits and you think, if where can you even shave the? It's not about the rough being long. It's about missing fairways and your ball being gone.
That's it. It's fairway so, or it's in the waste area.
So, yeah. Yeah. So you wondered, is that a venue that suits the American team? So it'll be interesting to see what Stricker decides to do. Yeah. Now, when you made those suggestions to Davis about Hazeltine, was he receptive? I'm impressed you had the guts to do it. And then I'm impressed if he was receptive to the input.
Yeah, I think that's a real reflection upon him and his character. And I think losing helps you look at things differently. I think he learned some things through the first time around. Yeah. And he did some things differently. But, he's talked about it even going into this year, is that when you're playing at home, I think Tiger was the guy who kind of encouraged him, and maybe even Azinger as well, is that turn up every stone, look for every bit of information that you can, and look at other perspectives. And I'm so thankful that they were willing to listen to mine. And I was able to contribute a little bit. But I think a lot of that comes down to the person and their character, and where do they kind of build a fortress around themselves and say, no, everything's going to be my idea. And that wasn't Davis at all. It's very indicative. Yeah, but I think to your point also, I had a prior relationship with him. I knew him a little bit and had a little level of comfort to speak up, but it's not easy to kind of ask your childhood hero, why do you think your team didn't win at Medina? And to give him the answer that I saw. But again, he was great about it all. And I think that played into our benefit.
That's cool. And you get that sense again, from when I spoke to him a couple of weeks ago, the way he reflected on his CBS stuff, like he doesn't have this massive ego where you have to say things that make him feel like he's right or something. And he's didn't seem at all afraid to sort of admit if he, his few shortcomings, if he, to talk about them. So that was pretty amazing. What were some of the other suggestions you had? I know, setting up the golf course, but you had, other insights as well that you gathered from your Minnesota winter of research.
Yeah, I think as far as playing the golf course, again, that's what I was trying to focus on so much in the golf course, but I did notice some other things. But with the golf course, I think one thing we looked at on his team at Medina in 2012 was, it seemed like to me, whenever things get tight and things get close, that we would flinch first, whether it was a short putt or a missed approach shot, and especially water. I think over the last 20 years, I'd started kind of counting up. We seem to hit it in the water about twice as much as the Europeans. It's like a magnet for us. Mm-hmm. And at Hazeltine, we had just rerouted the golf course so that our stroke play holes 6, 7, and 8 all have water in front of the green. We're now going to be the closing holes in Ryder Cup. And I kind of cringe to think about how many times we're going to hit it in the water on those pivotal holes, and especially if the wind blows. And so one thing I brought up was that Medina, if you look at holes 17 and 18 on Sunday, they put the hole location back right on 17 at Medina. They put it front right on 18. And there are two of the toughest hole locations, especially number 18. Our players kept hitting it to the back left, and you couldn't two putt from there. I think Furyk, Bubba, Webby, Stricker, and Furyk all hit it to the back left, and they all of them, three putted from there. You couldn't two putt to that hole location. So one thing I just tried to bring up was like, look, if we tend to play tight and we're used to having these guys play aggressive on tour, can we just consider putting these hole locations as close to the middle as we can? Just, especially on those closing holes, put them as far away from the water as we can. Like, they should have to lay sod over it to get wet. And if you look back on Sunday, that's exactly what they did. They just took, the difficulty out of it. Justin Rose made that comment about how the course was set up like a pro-am, and we were kind of high-fiving. But we also knew, like, for as easy as we set it up, they're going to set it up difficult at Paris, and they did. And we've got to figure out how to beat that. I think Maverick McNealy was here in 2019 during the KPMG. He and Danielle Kang were together, and we were talking about this. I think Mav said what I think is really right. He goes, the real test of a Ryder Cup is, can you win on the road? And the Americans haven't won on the road since 1993, whereas the Europeans won here in 95, 04, and 12. So I think Paul Azinger also said it better. I think one thing you see with them is, we might think that we have the better players, but they have the better team. And that comes across. I think there was a very good team here in 2016. The other thing that I saw was just that we hadn't really seen with the Americans before was, if you remember, Jordan Spieth won the first two majors in 2015. He won the Masters. He won at Chambers Bay. He goes to St. Andrews, and everyone's talking about Bobby Jones. And he came up one shot shy. He had to birdie 18 to get in the playoff. And Zach Johnson ended up winning the playoff. And as Zach's coming off the last green, the first guy to go out and congratulate him was Jordan Spieth. And we just had not seen that from Americans before. And it became a trend of Americans being happy for other Americans. And when Jimmy Walker won at Baltusrol, you saw the same guys stand around to congratulate Jimmy. And like, what that does for a team. And, you know, we struggled with that for a lot of years with Phil and Tiger. They were the top two Americans. And it seemed like there was kind of a fear of scarcity. Like, they didn't want to share majors and they were competing against each other. And, you know, I don't know everything, but it just seemed like watching it that we couldn't turn that off and come together for a week. And I'm concerned that that might still be some of the issues that we're dealing with, as, you know, a lot of this stuff is playing out in the public is, you know, can we come together and want to win for each other for 1 week?
Definitely want to talk about that and the team dynamic of, you know, what the Ryder Cup team in 2021, how it's comprised. It's actually kind of interesting. It, you know, maybe some Stricker's moves would be, his selections at least seem kind of in line with your thinking there, picking a lot of younger people, a lot of new people, sort of high energy grinders, fighters. You know, it's going to be interesting. The team room in 2016, though, I think there's a, I remember you told me once, there's a cool story about the dynamic of, you know, 2016, you had a good group, but also the way that they sort of got together and the amount of time they spent together. I'm not going to give you all the credit because I know you don't want it, but you did make a cool suggestion once.
Yeah, it's, you put this in your book, and I think I was telling you that story, not thinking that I was going to go that way, but
sorry.
So it's fine. No, it's fine. And it was something that I'm glad we could laugh about when the moment came around. But going back and watching old Ryder Cups, you know, it seems like we had a lot of celebrities around the first tee. We had them around the team room. Michael Jordan was the most notable of them. And it just seemed like, you know, is that distracting our team? Is that helping our team? You know, if we were winning a lot, I wouldn't say anything about it. But when I see some things at some of the losses, you know, the comment that I made to Tom Lehman was, you know, when I look at some of these guys, like, I know we all look up to him, you know, a guy like Keegan Bradley, like, you know, these guys worship, you know, the ground that Michael walks on. Of course, you're playing a Ryder Cup in Chicago. How do you not tap into that? It just felt like a distraction for me. And one of the best things I think the team did in 2016 was they were playing a playoff event in Boston. And I think Tom and Davis aligned it to where they can meet with the New England Patriots. And you had Robert Kraft and Belichick. And I want to say Brady might've been around it, but it might've just been Belichick and Kraft. But I think Belichick told the captains, look, get all the distractions away from your team. There are a lot. And make sure every player understands their role because they all have one. They all need to understand the role they play on the team. And I think that helped. And I think that's when they started listening to, like, look, our team room needs to be our team and no one else. So Michael Jordan and a lot of other guys got told to sit outside and it went our way. And I think they saw that. Where I was kind of laughing about it with you was I was down in Florida in early 2020. And we had some friends in the pro at Grove 23, which is the course that Michael's opened up there in Hope Sound, had invited us to come out for a day. And the place was brand new. It's a spectacular place, especially what they've done on this one end of the range that caters to the tour professionals. I mean, they've done everything. It's outstanding.
That sounds cool. The practice setup there sounds ridiculous.
It is a practice setup that is meant to test the number one player in the world. So all the targets are built to what the number one player in the world would do. And basically, if you can't hit it in those targets, you're not the number one player in the world. I mean, you got to talk about a place that Dustin Johnson and Rory McIlroy practice. So it's going to drive those guys. JT is also out there. But we played the round. I was telling Ken Wyan, the head pro there, that as we went around, I said, you know, if Michael met me, he probably wouldn't like me because I was the guy who suggested he shouldn't be in the team room in 2016. And I kind of told him the background, like I'm telling you. And we come up on some of the final holes and turns out, you know, Ken's like, oh, Michael's coming around today. I said, you know, I've never met Michael. Look forward to meeting him. And then we were kind of in the clubhouse having lunch after and was sitting next to him. And Kenny goes, hey, Michael, you know, you weren't allowed in the team room there in 2016, were you? He goes, no, first time ever. He goes, you know, that's Chandler's suggestion that you shouldn't be allowed in. And we're all familiar with, you know, Michael kind of gives that side eye and that smile and he looks at me. And I said, look, think of it this way. You know, when you were playing with the Bulls, would Michael Jordan or would Tiger Woods be allowed to come in your locker room during halftime of game seven? And, you know, he kind of said, you know, without the other words, which you put in your book, he goes, heck no. And, but he smiled. He goes, you know what? You did the right thing. And they won. So you definitely did the right thing. But, it was a nervous moment there for a second, when you meet a guy like that, but he's such a Ryder Cup fan and I'm sure he'll be there at Whistling. Actually, I know he's going to be there at Whistling. Kenny was telling me the other night and I said, we can all hang out outside the team room together now that I'm outside it too. So
yeah. Right. Now that we're all, now that nobody's allowed in the team room, was there any wagering in the holes that you played with, his airness?
No, he didn't play. He had just hurt his hand. So he's just kind of hanging around.
And I'm wagering at lunch, perhaps. I heard he likes to wager. I don't know.
No, he does. And I'm glad that didn't happen. I don't have the pockets to throw down with a guy like that.
Yeah. Right. Fast forward to 2021 and this year's team. I want to talk about the lineups and Stricker's decisions as well as Captain Harrington's decisions. First, I maybe talk about like someone who's not on the American team because he had such a big role in 2016. And that would be everybody's favorite Patrick Reed. Love him or hate him, he does seem cut from a certain cloth. He seems sort of, I don't know, built for that environment, for that sort of, for that Ryder Cup cauldron.
He is, and certain players are, and I think certain players are not. I remember in 2014, Phil Mickelson made a comment during a press conference before the tournament started. He said, Patrick Reed will change the dynamic of this team for the next 10 years. And what we have to remember about Reed in 2014 was, I think he had won a few times on tour. I remember after he won at Doral, he self-proclaimed himself as a top five player in the world. And we're all kind of going, who are you, you know, to proclaim yourself as that? But he has a certain swagger and confidence. And I know it's brash and it's arrogant and it's standoffish to some people. But when it comes to Ryder Cup, you want these people on your team, people that are going to just go out there and mow over your opponents. And Reed was one of those. We saw in 2014 at Glen Eagles, he missed a short putt on Saturday night. He came out Sunday morning in the second match against Stenson. He got heckled and it just flipped a switch on him. And we used to see this with Seve. You know, Seve would find that edge, especially in his matches against Azinger. But it's funny. I listened to the Davis Love podcast. He was on here, the episode, hopefully before mine. And Davis talked about it. He said, you know, it's the Ryder Cup seemed to come down to who makes the most putts. But he also kind of noted that it's usually won by the bottom six. And Europe tends to have this bottom six of these players that maybe we're not that familiar with here in the States or we don't recognize as much, but they really show up in Ryder Cups. And you look at some of their players over the years. I mean, Ian Poulter is a perfect example of a player who's never won a major, but you want him on your team every time a Ryder Cup is played. Lee Westwood is like that. I know Sergio won a major, but Sergio is like that. And in other players that we've seen, you know, come up through the years, Colin Montgomery never won a major, but look at how great he was in Ryder Cup. So there are certain players that just seem to be built for it. Patrick Reed, I know he didn't play great in the team setting in Paris or maybe in Australia, but his confidence level here in 2016, Saturday night, he basically had just beat Rose and Stenson by himself. Jordan Spieth was helping a little bit, but Jordan was struggling. Reed played great. And, you know, to come into the team room that night and realize that they're going to put Rory out first because Rory's going to want to lead that team onto the field. They're down three. Rory was playing great. And for Patrick Reed to say, look, I want to go out first. Whoever they're sending out first, I want to go first. And the result was we got that epic match that we're all still talking about today.
Totally epic. You know, it's one where I'll actually go back and watch that on, you know, I'm not one to go down those like YouTube rabbit holes on a lot of like golf highlights, but Rory, Patrick Reed, I mean, there was just stuff that happened in that match that was just completely unbelievable. And you were there on the grounds.
I was, and I try to remind people, you know, and same goes for you. You know, you're going to go to this Ryder Cup and the tournament that I enjoy the most, you know, going to as a spectator is the Masters because you can't bring your phone in. You can't get distracted. You just have to soak it all in with your eyes. And when it comes to the Ryder Cup, I don't have a lot of pictures. I certainly wasn't going to ask players, hey, let's go over here and take a selfie or taking my phone out when I'm right in the middle of all of this. And I'm not even regretting that I didn't. You know, we're on this podcast and when people ask me about these memories, I hope my memory will stay with me as long as it can because I have such great memories And, you know, Tom, you and I are in the storytelling business, and I love being able to tell people about what I saw or what I experienced, you know, more than just showing them a picture or a video. I got to see some of the magic, and I'm all too happy to go down memory lane and retell these things for people, but I got to see it and I got to live it, and I'm so thankful for it.
It's awesome. I'm wondering what magic awaits this year at Whistling Straits. If we look at the team, and you've mentioned, you know, that certain players are cut out for this stuff, and more so than other players. And it's just, you don't know why. And, you know, some are built for majors, some are built for Ryder Cup. And so if you look at if we break this down just for a moment, Colin Morikawa, Dustin Johnson, Bryson and Brooks, Justin Thomas, Patrick Cantlay, Tony Finau, Xander, Jordan, Harris English, Daniel Berger, and Scottie Scheffler. You look at that team, what are your thoughts in terms of, I mean, because you're talking about, you know, the Ryder Cup isn't necessarily made for flatliners. We might have a couple flatliners in there. I'm not going to say who. What are your feelings on the team? No Patrick Reed. There weren't two, I guess, Stricker, not too many controversial picks here, but four rookies in his captain's picks. So young, excitement. I don't know. I look at this and I do see some energy.
I do too. And I think rookies bring that. I mean, there's only a first time you can do something like this. So rookies, I think, are positive. I mean, all the names that you just mentioned, I mean, all these guys have won at the highest level. There are, you know, arguably our best 12 players, but I think it kind of goes back to what you just touched upon, which is for me, certain players excel in match play. And certain players have that swagger and that confidence to play on this stage. I was kind of reminded of that yesterday. We're watching Billy Horschel win the BMW at Wentworth. And, you know, Billy Horschel won two tournaments after the deadline there in 2014. He probably should have been on that team. They've changed the rules to where we don't leave a hot player like that out. But Billy Horschel won the match played Austin earlier this year, beat Scottie Scheffler. And plays with a lot of passion and emotion. To me, like, I want players like that on my team. I also want, you know, chemistry in the room, laughter. Kuchar was so great here in 2016 about keeping guys loose and having that laughter. And I'm just curious who's going to fill that role within this team. It seems like Justin Thomas will be your emotional leader as far as how he plays the game, very much like Ian Poulter. He's going to play with that passion and that intensity. But who's that offset with the comedic relief? And I would have liked to have seen Kevin Na get a look. I think Kevin Na won the tour championship if they all had started at even. But the way he walks putts in, you know, and has that looseness and that swagger and that comedic relief. Tom, there's no telling. I mean, second guess people until the gun goes off. And you just never know who's going to sink or swim in this environment. It's like stepping into the octagon and the gun goes off and it's sink or swim. And it's one of my favorite weeks. There's some people that want the Ryder Cup to happen every year. I love that we get a year break because it just builds that anticipation for it. And it's a treat when it comes around. And, you know, with an extra year here of COVID, I hope we really all appreciate that we're getting to watch this come together again.
I know. Everyone's got a plan until they get punched in the face. Because I'm looking at this list and I'm thinking, right, who is the... I mean, there's people on the American side. You can see them getting fired up being an emotional leader. But who is a player that they sort of... whether it's taking comfortable in the spotlight, taking attention, that this sort of fills that like Ian Poulter role. Like if Ian Poulter and Lee Westwood go out and get on a roll and get hot, who on this side, on the American side, is a good match there? Of course, it depends on how they're playing. You can say anybody really, but definitely the makeup. Then looking at Europe, John Rahm, Tommy Fleetwood, Terrell Hatton, Bernd Weisberger, Rory, Hovland, Paul Casey, Matt Fitzpatrick, Lee Westwood, Shane Lowry, Sergio Garcia, and Ian Poulter. You know, when you're talking about the fun person in the team room, the hangout factor of which team I want to hang out with. I'm sorry, Chandler. I know how strongly you feel about pulling for our side. And I say our as Americans, but the hangout factor, Europe is strong to quite strong. Especially I think with the selection of Shane Lowry, I love that pick. Not just because the Irish bias. I just think that, well, Whistling Straits is going to be a good, I mean, Duke can flight his ball. and he just looks like he's from Wisconsin. I mean, he looks like brats and beers. I think both sides are going to love him. So, you know, good picks by Harrington. We'll see what happens. I don't know. I like you said, you wish, you know, every other year helps it sort of build up the suspense. I'd almost go so far as to say I would love it if it was like every 4 years, like the Olympics, to even have more building up of the, you know, of the suspense. Because what for me is a bit of a drag is to have it every other year, but then have the President's Cup in the middle and have, so we have an international team every year. It would just be kind of more special because Europe has no problem getting up for this. And that's always the refrain. We lose and we go back to like, oh, our players don't care. They make too much money. They're in their own brand and universe, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if they played one international match every 4 years and then you have the Olympics in it. So playing for your country, there's a lot of opportunities to sort of play for your flag, if you will. I would almost rather like either lose the President's Cup or see it played every 4 years. I don't know.
Yeah, I think that's it is just as an outsider looking in again, I think just from what I've seen and what I've heard and what I've watched, it just seems like the Americans, we need to find our why. And Europe has found their why. I mean, this is how they come together and fight for the European Tour. But also, you know, back to what we heard Davis say is like, you know, we tend to not know the names of their bottom six. You know, these Bernd Wiesbicker type players or Bill Hattons or some of the guys from a few years ago. I mean, but you look at the passion that John Rahm played in that match against Tiger Woods. This is their opportunity to say like, look, we may not win as many majors as you, but when it comes to playing as a team, we're going to show you how this is done. And Paul McGinley's put out a fantastic book called Landscape for Success. And I encourage people to get their hands on it, or I encourage people to watch on YouTube, the video from 2018, and just type in 2018 European Ryder Cup team and watch the motivational video that they show their team the night before the Ryder Cup. And, you know, basically they tell their team, look, you can wake up on Monday as a Ryder Cup winner, or you can wake up as a loser. Leave it all on the field and don't leave with any regrets. And Tiger Woods told a story to the team at the end of the 2016 Ryder Cup that I'll share real quick that I think people need to hear. You know, I think early on in Tiger's career, the Ryder Cup, you know, we've talked about this early in the podcast. It's going into it, you kind of look at it and you go, it's not that big a deal. They try to almost downplay it, whereas Europe upplays it. And Tiger gathered the team on Sunday night at Ryder Cup after they had won. They'd done the press conference. They've done the closing ceremony. And he pulled the guys together and said, hey, tonight, when we go back to the hotel, let's really stay up late and enjoy this one. And the guys kind of chuckled because they thought he was kidding. And he said, the reason I tell you guys that is that in 99, when we had the comeback win at Brookline, we go back to the hotel and we party, we have dinner, we have drinks, but this entire week just takes it out of you. So by 10:30, I went up in my room and I got in bed. And within about an hour later, somebody's pounded on my door. And every year in the Ryder Cup, it's team members on the same floor. So he knows it's one of the players. Whoever it is not going away. So he finally gets out of bed and he answers the door, and it's Payne Stewart. And Payne's got the big smile on his face and says, what are you doing? And he says, dude, I'm already in bed. Yeah, you guys go ahead without me. Mm-hmm. He says, no, get dressed and get downstairs. And Tiger says, Payne, what's the big deal? He says, Tiger, the big deal is you never know if you're ever going to get to do this again. So you make it last as long as you can. And, you know, got to remember, this is only Tiger's second Ryder Cup. They've won one, lost one. He looks at Payne. He goes, Payne, we're going to win this thing over 2 years. And Payne looks at him and says, you don't know that. Get dressed and get downstairs. And Tiger says, I'm so thankful that he came back and got me that night. He says, I'll always remember that night. I'll remember the teammates that I had in that Ryder Cup and how special it was. And Payne was right. That's the only winning Ryder Cup team I ever played on. And we lost him 3 weeks later.
Yeah.
So you could see it, sense it on Tiger of like, you know, telling the guys, like, look, enjoy these moments. You don't know when they come around again. And when your playing career is done, you know, you got to remember the things that you did individually. But Tom Lehman was giving a gift to his team when he was captain in 2006. He had a painting commissioned from the K Club. It was the 18th hole at the K Club. It's got a creek that kind of runs through the hole in front of the green. And he gave it as a gift to the guys. He said, look, it's when you look at this painting, just remember you were one of the best 12 players, you know, this year. And that's something to be proud of. But if you look in the lower left-hand corner, I had the artist add in, it's a father teaching his son how to fish. And he said, I really believe that when your time is done, if all people talk about is what you did as a player and the tournaments that you won, that you'll have missed the magic. You know, what life is all about is what you leave behind and what you teach others. And this was the year that Tiger lost his father. He kind of looked over, he saw Tiger roll his eyes. But, you know, if you watch Tiger when he won the Masters in 2019, I mean, you're going to tell me that, you know, having the relationship with his son and his daughter doesn't matter. You know, life and perspective changes the older that we get, and the things that we felt like were important are not as important anymore. So it's perspective that I've got right in front of me right now. And it's everything that I'm trying to grasp as a husband and father myself.
Really well said, Chandler. You know, there's some interesting, exciting developments going on in your own life. So some changes since the two man, when a lot of our subscribers and folks, our Broken Tee Society members, got to meet you at Hazeltine and just had so many amazing things to say about the event and how much they appreciated you and your staff. But since then, some things have changed, and I just wanted to give you a moment to speak about them and tell us, you know, what's going on with you. And you know, I think it's exciting. And I know this interview has been tough to do because it's brought back a lot of memories of, you know, your these incredible times you've had at Hazeltine. And what's the next step? Where are the next memories? Tell us about that.
No, thank you. I wouldn't say this interview has been tough to do. I'm thankful to do it. I think it's dawning on me just right now. Like, this is, you know, the last interview I'll do is that professional at Hazeltine. And that's the emotion that I think you hear from me is just, it's gratitude. From the time that I watched Davis as a kid, all I wanted to be was a golf professional. And that's, you know, what I was running towards. All the long hours and the sacrifice you put into it. And you just hope that you're going to make it to the top of the hill. And I would have been thankful to be the head pro anywhere, but it was Hazeltine National that called me that fall of 2012 and it made my dream come true. And I'm so thankful that they did. You know, the magic that I've gotten to experience here for 9 years, you know, not just the Ryder Cup or the championships, but it's the, I think I remember Stuart Appleby talking about his late wife. You know, it's all the little things that go into your day that mean the most. It's all these relationships that I have with the staff, the members, that I'll miss. You know, I'm at a crossroads in my career, and making this decision to resign and leave Hazeltine National. When we started this podcast, I was looking at the wall behind you, and you have a great gift from your daughters that says, you know, here are all the things that we love about our dad. And my wife has kind of reminded me, you know, it's when you're in this chair that I'm in, we get the opportunity to go do a lot of really fun things. And it's take a lot of self-restraint to say no to a lot of it. But she kind of has a saying that we laughed about. I was thinking about making a t-shirt for her, but she said, you know, I'm kind of tired of the once in a lifetime opportunity because they seem to happen to you a lot, you know, with all these opportunities and things that we get to go do. And I think it's just in the recent past that I've started to wake up and realize that all the things that I've gotten to do, the once in a lifetime opportunity that I have left is to be a father and a husband. And I have three amazing girls, 10, 5, and 2 at home. And I love being a golf professional. It's one of the greatest honors in my life is when people refer to me as the pro. I can't tell people how much that's meant to be, for all the respect that I have for the PGA members, that they're in line with me, all my peers, and, you know, the sacrifice and the hard work that goes into what we do. If this is it for me as being a pro, it's been an honor, and I don't know what the next chapter holds. I don't have something lined up, but I've been at this point in my career before where the future is unknown, and it's exciting. It's scary. But we'll continue to trust, that there's a plan for our lives. And I love the game of golf. I hope I find a way to still serve it and be around it. And the people that play this game, like your listeners, because they are the greatest people that I've met through this game. And for what golf has given me and my family, we'll never be able to repay that. So we'll wrap up here. We're going to go to the Ryder Cup and we're going to come home and we'll start seeing what's out there. But I hope, again, I get a chance to serve the game in a place that fits for me and my family. But in wrapping up here, you know, some of the Hazel team members are listening. It is a eternal thank you. It's hard to describe, but it has been one of the greatest chapters of our life. And it's not hard at all to look back on these. These are great memories. And I'm thankful that I got to share them with everyone here.
Chandler, incredibly well said, and exciting chapters ahead as well. It's not going to be your last time on this podcast, no doubt. You have a lot left to give to golf and a lot more things I want to pick your brain about through your experiences, no doubt. Chandler, I will see you in Wisconsin. Thank you so much for the time. You're the best. Love you, man. Can't wait to hear about your next chapter as well.
Love you too, TC. Thanks for having me on.